Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Saudi King to skip U.S. Gulf Summit. Saudi Arabia's King Salman will not take part in a U.S. Arab summit hosted this week by President Barack Obama, Foreign Minister Adel al-Jubeir said Sunday. The Saudi king also canceled a planned White House meeting that had been announced only days earlier. The summit begins Wednesday with delegations from the six-member Gulf Cooperation Council visiting the White House, then continues Thursday with talks at Camp David Presidential Retreat. Jubeir said King Salman will send Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef in his place. He cited the summit's overlap with a five-day ceasefire and humanitarian effort in neighboring Yemen, where Saudi Arabia has led a campaign of airstrikes against anti-government fighters. An Obama administration official said the charge was not in response to any substantive issue. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg accused Russia Monday of violating the ceasefire in the Ukrainian conflict by continuing to supply pro-Russian separatists with military aid. His assessment of the continuing conflict in eastern Ukraine came as the U.S. State Department announced that Secretary of State John Kerry is traveling to Sochi, Russia for a Tuesday meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin about the Ukrainian crisis and conflicts in the Middle East. Russia has rejected Western accusations that it is overseeing the fighting in Ukraine. It is Kerry's first trip to Russia since fighting erupted in eastern Ukraine more than a year ago between pro-Russian separatists and Kiev's forces after Moscow annexed Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. This is VOA News. U.S. officials faced questions Monday in Geneva about the use of the death penalty, excessive force by police, and national security measures as the U.N.'s Human Rights Council conducted a review of the country's rights practices. Justice Department official James Cadogan cited a number of recent high-profile cases involving police killing unarmed black men, saying the U.S. must do better to uphold civil rights. The use of the death penalty in the United States also drew wide attention, with nations calling for abolishing the practice. South Korea has expressed concern about North Korea's test firing of a submarine-based ballistic missile, calling it very serious and worrying, and urging Pyongyang to stop development efforts. North Korea announced Saturday it had successfully test-fired a submarine-based ballistic missile, but did not reveal the exact time, date, and location of the test. Analysts are divided on just how much progress North Korea has actually made with its submarine-based missile development program, citing the country's antiquated fleet of submarines. South Korea's Defense Ministry spokesman Kim Min-suk told reporters Saturday that it is believed 4 to 5 years are needed to develop the technology. Turkish authorities have tightened controls, ending their open-door policy for Syrian refugees and making it more difficult for Syrians to enter Turkey and for international journalists to cover the war. There are even reports of people being fired upon. Jamie Detmer has more from the Syrian-Turkish border.
Lina Shawaf is the editor of the independent Syrian radio station Rizana, which broadcasts from studios in Paris and Gaziantep, Turkey. She was a well-known TV personality in Damascus until she fled after siding with the political opposition against President Bashar al-Assad as violence flared in 2011. She's been returning to rebel-held areas of northern Syria when possible.
I feel like I have to go there. I have to see in my eyes, to see the truth.
But trying to see what reporters call ground truth can be perilous. Barrel bombs are raining down on Aleppo, the battered northern Syrian city half held by rebels. And there is the danger of journalists being kidnapped by jihadist groups like Al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Ufa.
And French President François Hollande arrived in Cuba late Sunday night, becoming the first French head of state to visit the communist nation. He plans to meet with Cuban President Raúl Castro Monday upon the Cuban leader's return from Italy, which included a visit with Pope Francis at the Vatican. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Legally, the right of all children to have a birth certificate or a legal existence have been respected. Socially, these children are not responsible of what happened in their country. They are vulnerable, and the government of the Republic cannot stay and see this situation per se.
That's Cameroonian government official Teofili Ngwebini commenting on Nigerian children born in Minawao refugee camp in northern Cameroon. Details coming up. Also in the news, Belgium has suspended $4.5 million in election aid to Burundi, where weeks of protest have thrown a June 8th presidential vote into uncertainty. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from the Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Belgium has suspended $4.5 million in election aid to Burundi, where weeks of protest have thrown a June 28th presidential vote into uncertainty. A diplomatic source in Brussels says the announced withdrawal of financial support by Burundi's former colonial ruler may signal further outside pressures to postpone the election. The Belgian aid package includes training for Burundi's police force. More than 2,000 demonstrators marched through the streets of Bujumbura, the capital, today as police looked on. Mr. Nkurunziza's ruling party has ignored warnings from other governments not to run for a third term. Critics say his candidacy violates a two-term limit set out in the Constitution and a peace deal that ended a civil war in 2005. At least 19 demonstrators have died in the past two weeks of demonstrations protesting his re-election bid. On Friday, the United States threatened sanctions against anyone involved in violence against protesters. Washington gives about $80 million a year in equipment and training to the army. The foreign ministers of neighboring African states meet on Wednesday in Tanzania to discuss the crisis. More than 50,000 people have fled to Rwanda and other neighboring states, many fearing a flare-up of ethnic violence. Aid agencies say Nigerian refugees give birth to 45 children every month at the Minawao refugee camp. Most of the children do not have official birth certificates. The government of Cameroon and the United Nations Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, have begun issuing the children birth certificates with the hope the Nigerian government will accept them when the refugees return. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Minawao refugee camp in northern Cameroon.
Isaac Luka, leader of the group of Nigerian refugees at the Minawao refugee camp in northern Cameroon, expressed gratitude to aid agencies for helping to establish birth certificates for their newborn babies.
We are very grateful because our children will benefit their civic rights. We thank the government of Cameroon and the head of the refugee partners, IADHCR, and the different UN agencies, without neglecting non-governmental organizations and the Cameroonian government to the attention they reserve for us.
Teofil Gea Beina, the highest Cameroon government official in the area, says the Nigerian children started enjoying their rights to birth registration following negotiations between the government of Cameroon and the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR.
Legally, the right of all children to have a birth certificate or a legal existence have been respected. Socially, these children are not responsible of what happened in their country. They are vulnerable, and the government of the Republic cannot stay and see this situation per se.
Gerasim Bouarem, UNHCR's associate reporting officer, says the birth registration does not confer Cameroonian nationality upon the refugee children. But he says by establishing a legal record on where a refugee was born and who their parents are, the kids can claim their Nigerian nationality when they become adults.
Where a child is born, he has the right to receive a birth certificate, which is not...
He says wherever children are born, they have the right to be issued birth certificates. But if they are born in a country different from that of their parents, they have up to 18 years when they become adults to decide to be nationals of that country if the constitution of the country allows him to have the nationality based on the fact that he was born there. Ombaneme Kaniset, a midwife at the refugee camp, says they prepare a birth declaration card for each newborn baby and forward it to UNHCR officials working in collaboration with other aid agencies and the government of Cameroon. She says an average of 45 babies are born each month.
Il y a des femmes qui arrivent effectivement qui sont déjà enceintes. Pour celles qu'on constate que le psychique est atteint.
She says they direct some of the pregnant women who arrive at the refugee camp from Nigeria with emergency cases to specialists and then encourage them to follow up their prenatal consultation. She adds that some of them have never had prenatal care and most of them do not have medical records since they are running from violence. Some of the mothers do not know the importance of birth certificates. Benjamin Mambu of the International Emergency and Development Aid, IEDA Relief, says they have been educating women who refuse to give their children names and those who refuse to collaborate with birth registration officers.
We continue to sensitize parents who didn't give us the name of their children, who didn't identify their children. We will do it and we'll continue to make sure that will be done. We'll continue to sensitize parents and to assist them in what that children become in the future. They will go to their country. The government of Nigeria will take care of them, but firstly, he and Cameroon will take care of them. We give them birth certificates and we assist them.
UNHCR's Bowing Muhammad, who has also been encouraging mothers to register their children at birth, says when the situation in Nigeria stabilizes and the refugees agree to return, they will organize a meeting with the Nigerian government to make sure the children are not discriminated against because they were born out of their country.
La question des actes de naissance, des diplômes que les enfants vont avoir au niveau du Cameroun.
He says a tripartite meeting of Cameroon, Nigeria and the United Nations Refugee Agency will be convened to examine birth certificates delivered to Nigerian children when CAM will return to their country and they agree to return. The UNHCR reports that since January this year, more than 11,500 Nigerians have arrived in the camp. The government of Cameroon says it has counted over 74,000 Nigerian refugees in Cameroon, and a majority are women and children. About 1,000 have so far received birth certificates. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Minawau, North.
Nigerian and regional military forces continue to push Boko Haram forces out of northeastern Nigeria, but more than a million displaced persons and hundreds of girls and women held captive by the extremists face daunting social and economic hurdles as they return home. Young women and girls kidnapped, raped, tortured, and forcibly married to Boko Haram fighters are now being shunned by their local communities as they return home. Even some who had escaped their kidnappers months ago are taunted as Boko Haram wives. The governor of Borno State has called for investigations of the paternity of children being born to the returning women. Governor Kashim Shitama has been quoted in the Nigerian press as expressing a fear that the babies could inherit their father's ideology. Human Rights Watch calls Shitama's remarks very unfortunate. Even larger numbers of Nigerians returning to devastated farmlands may soon need food aid as they resettle after a year or more. Farmlands have been untilled as thousands sought refuge in other parts of the country. They have returned home along roads heavily mined, crossed rivers where bridges have been destroyed, and found most of their farm equipment destroyed or missing. One community leader complained there's no food. Sick people do not have access to hospitals, and there's no vegetables, lemons, or bananas. He said all farm machinery has been burned or taken, and communities are not able to return to farming. You are listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz, on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Sixteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Belgium has suspended $4.5 million in election aid to Burundi, where weeks of protests have thrown a June 28th presidential vote into uncertainty. And the UNHCR begins issuing birth certificates to Nigerian newborns in the Minawao refugee camp in northern Cameroon. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. South Africa's main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, has elected its first black leader. Mamsu Maimane takes over from Helen Zille, who has been at the helm of the party for 8 years. From Johannesburg, Gillian Parker has a profile on the young new leader.
At 34 years of age, the charismatic politician, known for his sharp oratory skills and slick campaigns, is often dubbed the Obama of Soweto. Mamsu Maimane pushes away such comparisons, but observers say his appointment as the new leader of the Democratic Alliance Party could help shift a political landscape that currently tilts heavily in favour of the ruling African National Congress Party. The eldest of four, Maimane was born in Krugersdorp and brought up in Soweto, a township on the edges of Johannesburg that became the political epicentre of the anti-apartheid struggle. Maimane joined the DA in 2010. He quickly rose through the ranks to become the party's national spokesman in 2011. Last year, he lost his bid to lead the provincial government of South Africa's wealthiest province, Gauteng. As the party's parliamentary leader, he accused President Jacob Zuma of being a thief during a heated parliamentary debate in March. His colleagues say he has a good sense of humour, but is an absolute perfectionist. On May 10th, Maimane became the DA's first black party leader during a party conference with 88.9% of the vote. Despite the DA's growth in the last few elections, 12.4% of the vote in 2004, 16.7% in 2009 and 22.2% in 2014, the party is still considered too white to threaten the supremacy of the ruling ANC, says political analyst Nick Berean. Electing Maimane as party leader is one of several steps the DA is taking to enable it to dig into the ANC's core constituency, Berean says.
Mosi is very specifically tailored. He's chosen, and his rise has been so quick because he fits exactly the profile of the DA. His appointment is a necessary but not sufficient condition for the DA to break out of its racial confines. Mosi is the transitional object.
Maimane has a bachelor's degree in psychology from the University of South Africa and a master's degree in theology from Bangor University in the United Kingdom. Before getting into politics, the gangly eloquent leader, included in GQ magazine's 2014 list of best-dressed men, lectured at a business school in Johannesburg. A devout Christian, he is a preacher at the Charismatic Discovery Church in Randburg.
Electing a leader who's a preacher in charismatic churches is a particular kind of appeal which the deer historically would have probably shied away from, a populist appeal. I think these are part of the many compromises the deer is prepared to make with its principled ideology historically to reach new voters, new black young voters.
The ANC has said that he is too young and that his rapid elevation is a symptom of racial tokenism, a label flatly rejected by Musi's colleague and Shadow Minister for Public Enterprises, Natasha Michaels.
Calling Musi a token, I think, is an absolute insult. And I think the fact that he received the overwhelming landslide victory that he did proves that black, white, coloured, Indian, Asian, we all agreed that he was the man for the job and he was the man to take us forward. The energy of his age is going to be a huge advantage. He brings a certain dynamic to Parliament that's desperately needed because we're a very young country.
Analysts say that Memani's appointment is unlikely to win the party a national vote, but could be a key step towards eroding the ANC's 20-year hold on power. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
On Saturday, Liberia became the first West African country to be officially called free of the Ebola virus that killed more than 11,000 people. The World Health Organization marked the end of the Ebola crisis in Liberia, that is, two incubation periods since the last known case. The nation's president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, called the outbreak a scar on the conscience of the world. At Saturday's announcement, Mrs. Sirleaf urged that the good news for Liberia be a call to arms that will build a better world for those Ebola could not reach as a memorial to those who died. Meanwhile, UNICEF's country representative cautioned that the next case is only a canoe ride away across the river or across a forest path. Sheldon Yet said the element of Ebola risk remains. New cases were still being reported this week in both Sierra Leone and in Guinea, where five of the new victims were only diagnosed after death. The fact they had never sought treatment for Ebola means health officials were not able to track anyone the diseased had come in contact with. The Venice Biennial, which opened May 9th, was set to feature a Kenyan pavilion for the third time ever, but only had one Kenyan artist. The rest were mostly Chinese artists with no ties to Africa. The Kenyan government has disavowed the pavilion, but as Hilary Hewler reports from Nairobi, Kenyan artists say it was a missed opportunity to showcase the country's growing talent.
Nearly every country is proud to have a pavilion at the Venice Biennale, considered by many to be the Olympics of the art world. Kenya, whose artists have only recently begun to make a name for themselves internationally, mounted its third pavilion this year. But when Kenyan artist Wambui Kamiru saw the lineup of artists, she was furious to find that almost none came from Kenya.
It's like people have just chosen to step into my space and decided that I don't exist as a Kenyan artist. They thought it was all right to bring somebody from another country to represent my voice. So, of course, I felt naturally angry about it. That's my flag, not someone else's flag.
Of the eight artists featured in the Kenyan pavilion, six were Chinese. Only one Kenyan made the list. This year's Biennale opens on May 9th, but the Kenyan pavilion has already caused such an uproar among the art community that last month Kenya's Minister of Culture, Hassan Wario, announced the government is officially disowning it. It isn't clear exactly how the pavilion came to be dominated by Chinese artists. The Italian organizing it has said he put thousands of dollars of his own money into the exhibition, without which it wouldn't have happened at all. Sylvia Gachia, who heads a Kenyan art center called Kuona Trust, says she would prefer to have no pavilion rather than a pavilion that looks like this one.
We'd much rather not be represented than be represented fraudulently and in the wrong way. Would we like it to be a Kenyan space? Yes. Would we like to have Kenyan artists in the pavilion? Absolutely. We just wouldn't stand to be misrepresented.
Kenya's artists could certainly use the international exposure, she adds. The country's art scene is growing fast and is attracting more and more recognition from abroad.
It's buzzing. We are attracting a lot of international attention because of the actual work that's being created by artists from this space. International art buyers are buying work from the East African region. We have artists like Paul Nditi, Miriam Kiambi, James Murioki, and the list can go on and on.
This isn't the first time foreign artists have stepped in to represent Kenya at Venice. The country's 2013 pavilion was heavily Chinese as well. Gachia is determined not to let it happen again. She says she and others in Kenya are working with the Italian embassy to figure out how to mount a more representative pavilion at the 2017 Biennale. It's an expensive undertaking. A visual artist who works from Kuona Trust, Tom Ogonga, isn't convinced the government will pay for it, or that Kenya's arts infrastructure is developed enough to put a pavilion together.
We need to do a lot of housekeeping. For example, now if somebody volunteers to fund a proper Kenyan pavilion in Venice, who is going to run with it? We don't even have a proper curator. We don't have an arts council. So I think in Kenya what we need is to get our act together.
As for this year's Biennale pavilion, it'll still be on display, but will no longer bear the Kenyan flag, which Gachia considers to be a victory in itself. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
And in news from outside the continent, Saudi Arabia's King Salman will not take part in a U.S.-Arab summit hosted this week by President Barack Obama, Foreign Minister Adel Al-Jubeir said yesterday. He also canceled a planned White House meeting that had been announced only days earlier. The summit begins Wednesday with delegations from the six-member Gulf Cooperation Council visiting the White House, then continues Thursday with talks at the President's Camp David retreat. Jubeir said King Salman will send Crown Prince Mohammed bin Yaf in his place. He cited the summit's overlap with a five-day ceasefire and humanitarian effort in neighboring Yemen, where Saudi Arabia has led a campaign of airstrikes against anti-government fighters. An Obama administration official said the change was not in response to any substantive issue. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's up, Africa? It's Jackson Vunganyi.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Cape Town.
Can I be upfront with you? That's exactly what Nadia and I plan to do every Wednesday at 1730 UTC. Upfront looks at issues that affect you.
Since the world is moving at a faster rate, they need to have a major computer.
Interesting news.
Canadian man was sentenced for drunk driving after being pulled over in his mother's motorized wheelchair. 35-year-old man was fined and placed on probation.
And of course, music. No clouds in my stones. Entertainment. celebrities, you name it, we'll talk about it.
And of course, we love to hear from you. Send us your thoughts and comments. Our email address is upfront@voanews.com.
So don't forget to check us out every Wednesday at 17:30 UTC on The Voice of America.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Belgium has suspended $4.5 million in election aid to Burundi, where weeks of protests have thrown a June 28 presidential vote into uncertainty. And the United Nations says 300,000 people in South Sudan have lost access to life saving aid after fighting forced relief groups to withdraw. Coming up, music from Uganda in our feature segment, The Global Burden of Armed Violence in 2015. I'm Yehiz Wuhiban, we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Yehias.
Sunny, I understand you have some kudos for an Ethiopian star.
Yehias, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to Haile Gebrselassie, considered one of the greatest distance runners of all time. The 42-year-old Ethiopian star says he's retiring from competitive running. Haile made the announcement after finishing 16th Sunday in the Great Manchester Run in England. While Haile says he'll still participate in future races, it's no longer with the intention of getting on the podium. During a running career that spanned more than two decades, Haile won back-to-back gold medals at 10,000 meters at the 1996 and 2000 Olympics. He first tasted international success at the 1992 Junior World Championships in Seoul, South Korea, where he won gold medals at both 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters. At the senior level, Haile Gebrselassie won four world titles at 10,000 meters. In addition, Haile set 27 world records at various distances, including the marathon. And while that one and others have been broken, Haile has been an inspiration for athletes in Africa and all over the world. And in terms of inspiration, one of my biggest sporting thrills was getting the chance to meet Haile Gebrselassie at the 2001 World Championships in Edmonton, Canada. Haile is also a successful businessman in Ethiopia. He has a variety of business interests, including real estate and the local coffee industry.
Hello, this is Haile Gebrselassie. You are listening to the Sunny Side of Sport on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma covered the South African Open Athletics Championships over the weekend, and Mark had a chance to talk with top athletes from South Africa and the Seychelles. Here's Mark.
Former Africa women's high jump champion Lisa Labichi improved her Seychelles high jump record to 1.92 meters when she won on Saturday. She's delighted.
I feel very, very excited right now because I jumped very well. Without my coach didn't come, so I'm proud, and this record is for my coach.
You came into this competition with your 1.88 meter Seychelles record. Take us through it.
In a World Junior, I did 1.88, and then in 2013, I was out because I had a baby, and then I came out 2014 and 2015. Now, today, I did my record, and I'm so happy. I was not thinking that I would break the record again because people, when I was pregnant, they put me down and discouraged me to not continue athletics. But I came out strong and I know I can do more better than that. It felt great to pass 192.
And then after that you tried 195.
Yes, but I didn't make it because now if I jump too much my ankle will be so swollen that I couldn't barely walk. So I will try it again later.
From here, what do you plan to do?
Train hard and improve my record again.
That was Lisa Labici, the Seychelles 2012 World Junior Championship Women's High Jump Silver Medalist, speaking in Tlokwe. Meanwhile, South African Roscoe Engel bettered his 200-meter lifetime best twice with winning times of 20.56 and 20.51 seconds. His confidence is high.
Well, I knew I had to push through the bend, especially in my semi-final. As soon as I pushed out the bend, I knew there was a PB. It was just a matter of holding out in the straight. During the final, I knew I had my work cut out again. I thought I was going to lack energy, but at the moment, I'm recovering quite well. Pushed out the exit, same story. I was longer into the straight, and it's another PB. I'm so happy.
You're very close to the World Championship qualifier at both events, and with these two PBs on one afternoon in a space of less than 2 hours, going forward, what are your thoughts?
I know that I have to quicken my bend ever so slightly, work on speed endurance a bit more. I'm pretty confident about hitting the time to qualify. I don't think that's an issue. It's just a matter of running more races over the two.
South African sprinter Roscoe Engels speaking in Tlokwe. I'm Mark Omar in Tlokwe, Northwest Province in South Africa.
Because this is Africa. Tami, tami, na, eh, eh. For Africa.
I'm very, 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 very excited.
Because this is Africa. This time for Africa.
In African football news, Rwanda and Botswana advanced to the second round over the weekend in the qualifying competition for this year's African Under 23 Championship in Senegal. Remember, VOA football fans, the African Under 23 Championship will double as a qualifying tournament for next year's Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. The top three teams at Senegal 2015 will book tickets to the Olympic men's football tournament. In Djibouti, Rwanda and Somalia played to a one-all draw Sunday. Isai Songa put Rwanda up 1-0 with a goal just 4 minutes into the match. Abbas Mohamed scored the equalizer for the Somalis at the hour mark. Rwanda won the first leg match 2-0 and won the series 3-1 on aggregate. Because of the unstable political situation in Somalia, the second leg match was moved to Djibouti. Rwanda will play Uganda in the next round of the qualifying competition. Meanwhile, in Nairobi on Saturday, Kenya beat Botswana 4-1. The boys from Botswana advanced on the away goal rule after a 4-all draw on aggregate. Botswana will play Zambia in the next round, which will also be over two legs. Joining us now with more football news is the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shagun Dot on the spot at Ayemi.
Good evening, Africa. Egyptian footballers have vowed their support for the country's iconic player, Mohamed Aboutrika. Reports from Egypt said the country's central bank has confiscated Aboutrika's assets. Aboutrika is accused of having ties to the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood. Among Egyptian footballers who have vowed support for Aboutrika are Egypt's most capped player, Ahmed Hassan, Zamalek's popular midfielder, Omar Geba, Egypt and Al Ahly goalkeeper, Sherif Ekrami, and Zamalek icon, Ahmed Hossam Mido. Aboutrika, a hugely popular footballing figure, hung up his boots in late 2013 after leading Egypt's most successful club, Al Ahly, to a host of domestic and continental trophies. He also helped Egypt to win Africa Cup of Nations titles in 2006 and 2008.
Hi, this is VOA's Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. You're listening to my friend Segun Dot on the spot at Adeyemi.
In more football news, African soccer's governing body, CAF, and the Qatar Football Association, QFA, have signed a five-year cooperation agreement for the development of football between the two organizations. CAF President Issa Hayatou and QFA President Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Ahmed Al Thani signed the agreement on Wednesday at the CAF headquarters in Cairo, Egypt. The cooperation will focus on exchange of expertise and experience in various areas, such as administration, coaching, sports medicine, refereeing, youth and women football, infrastructure development, marketing and communications. Elsewhere, Brazilian soccer legend Pele left hospital on Saturday after undergoing prostate surgery. Tests showed that he has a benign condition. The 74-year-old Pele left the Albert Einstein Hospital in Sao Paulo on Saturday evening, according to a statement from the hospital. This was the second time the former footballer had been hospitalized in 6 months. With more than 1,280 career goals and an unequal 3 World Cup titles during his playing career, Pele is widely considered the greatest soccer player of all time. Pele was named Athlete of the Century by the International Olympic Committee in 1999. Finally, this sad news from the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DR Congo. Former national team defender Joseph Ilunga has passed away following a long illness. Ilunga died at the age of 66 at St. Joseph Hospital in Kinshasa, the capital of DR Congo, on Friday. He also played for the Congolese club TP Mazembe, which he helped to win the African Champions Cup, now CAF Champions League, back-to-back in 1967 and 1968. He was also part of the successful DR Congo team that won the Nations Cup in 1968 and 1974. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
The National Basketball Association playoffs continue later Monday night with two games. In the first game of the evening, my beloved and magical Washington Wizards will host the Atlanta Hawks, and that will be followed by a game between the Memphis Grizzlies and the visiting Golden State Warriors. The Wizards and the Grizzlies each lead their best-of-seven game series 2-1. In results Sunday, LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers edged the Chicago Bulls 86-84. That series is now tied at 2 games each. LeBron made a jump shot from the corner at the buzzer to lift the Cavaliers to victory. And in Southern California, the host Los Angeles Clippers defused the Houston Rockets 128-95 to take a 3-1 lead in the Western Conference semifinals. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, the global burden of armed violence in 2015. And next, fish farming in Cameroon. But first, some music. Here is Blue 3 of Uganda with Mapenzi Yako. Blue 3 of Uganda with Mapenzi Yako. A new report stemming from a small arms survey estimates 508,000 people have met a violent death every year from 2007 to 2012. Nevertheless, authors of the Global Burden of Armed Violence 2015 note the number represents a small decrease in the number of global violent deaths reported in previous years. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The 3% decline from the number of violent deaths recorded between 2004 and 2007 is a bit of good news, but small comfort to the more than 1.5 billion people around the world who live in countries affected by violence and conflict. While the global number of violent deaths has gone down, the report finds a larger proportion of deaths were directly related to conflict. It also finds the economic impact of homicide has increased to $171 billion in 2010 from $160 billion in 2000. Small Arms Survey Research Director Anna Alvazi Del Frata says data show most cases of violent deaths were concentrated in a group of 18 mainly non-conflict countries, with many of the deaths related to criminality and homicide. These countries, she says, averaged more than 30 violent deaths per 100,000 people.
So this means that the level here is more than 4 times higher than the global average. These 18 countries represent only approximately 4% of the world population, but experience almost 1/4 of the total violent deaths. And in this group of countries, only 1/3 is at war. They are concentrated mostly in parts of Latin America and Africa.
In 2012, the report ranked Syria with more than 180 per 100,000 deaths as the world's most violent country, followed by Honduras and Venezuela. The report says domestic violence remains a huge problem, but it finds the number of female victims of homicide in 2012 had decreased globally by almost 10% from 2004 to 60,000 in 2012. It says Honduras and El Salvador had the most dramatic increases in the rate of female homicides. While South Africa registered the sharpest drop, it says the number of women murdered in that country every year remains high. The Small Arms Survey says firearms were used in 44% of all violent killings, followed by knives, which account for 1/3 of all killings. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Cameroon, fish farming was once a pastime to supplement family protein intake, but today it's becoming a major part of the country's food industry. Eugene Mforangwa reports from Yaoundé on the sector's slow but certain transformation.
Even though the country has a long coastline and is endowed with lakes and rivers, most of the fish consumed here is imported. In 2014 and previous years, Cameroon imported about 200,000 tons of fish and only produced about 180,000 tons. Officials say both imports and national production are not able to meet growing demand of more than 400,000 tons annually. To fill the gap, the government is banking on fish farming, an old sector that until recently remained underused. Divine Tambo is the head of aquaculture development at the Ministry of Livestock, Fisheries and Animal Industries.
Fish farming is the sector we call the sector of the future for Cameroon because we feel it is more profitable and has more opportunities for advancement than other sectors of livestock rearing.
According to the ministry, 5,000 farmers currently operate 7,000 fish ponds around the country. The country's fish farms occupy some 1,000 hectares, the size of about 1,600 soccer pitches, but currently they only produce about 2,000 to 3,000 tons per year, too small to meet expanding shortage.
Fish farming was introduced by colonial administration in 1948, but it was mostly a subsistence fish farming for food security.
Since then, it was practiced as a pastime to diversify family protein intake. Individuals build small ponds in their backyards, producing just enough for their households. As a result, natural stocks became overexploited. production stagnated at less than 200,000 tons per year and began plummeting about 5 years ago. The government also realized Cameroon was spending too much importing fish, which could be bred locally. 4 years ago, livestock and fishery officials began changing the sector's outlook by encouraging smallholders to open bigger farms.
Now we are proposing fish farming as a commercial activity, as a very lucrative activity, more than other activities in the livestock and even agricultural sector.
Tambu explains that developing fish farming has benefits beyond increasing the quantity of an affordable source of proteins. The activity, he says, can diversify revenue sources for fishermen, create new jobs, and allow natural stocks to regenerate. However, several hurdles still need to be lifted for aquaculture to make a meaningful contribution to the national fish industry.
We have two basic problems, the seed, which are the fingerlings, and then the feed for feeding the fish. Last year, we produced close to 3 million fingerlings. This is very insignificant because we need close to 50 million fingerlings to be able to shock the 7,000 ponds in the country. People are abandoning their ponds because they do not have fingerlings to put in.
Feed accounts for roughly 75% of fish farm investments. But scarcity and high cost have rendered the sector uncompetitive. All the feed currently used in the country is imported indirectly through neighboring Nigeria. On the local market, it sells for about $4 per kilo. A kilo of fish is only a dollar more expensive. The government has built a new plant that will soon begin producing about 1,200,000 tons of feed annually. However, even assuming that everything goes as planned, aquaculture is only projected to account for about 10,000 tons of fish annually in the next 3 years. Reporting for VOA Africa, I am Eugene Fongo in Yaoundé.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Togolese President Faure Gnassingbé has been sworn in for a third term leading the West African nation, following his victory in the April 25th presidential balloting. Togo's Constitutional Court confirmed the National Election Commission's tally, finding that the president polled 59% of the more than 1.2 million votes cast, to leading opposition candidate Jean-Pierre Fabre's 35%. While Togo's main opposition party voiced concerns over the voting count, and civil society noted broader concerns about the electoral process leading up to Election Day, international observers, including the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, the African Union, and the Gorée Institute, judged the election free and fair. Equally important, Mr. Fabre and others conceded the results, sparing the nation the kind of political tension and protest that cost hundreds of lives after the 2005 election. The United States congratulates the people of Togo on exercising their democratic rights, and we look forward to continuing to work with President Gnassingbé to strengthen Togo's democracy and build a prosperous nation for the Togolese people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, Africa. This is James Brotty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
What's up, Africa? It's Jackson Vunganyi.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Cape Town.
Can I be upfront with you? That's exactly what Nadia and I plan to do every Wednesday at 1730 UTC. Upfront looks at issues that affect you.
Since the world is moving at a faster rate, there's need to have a major computer.
Interesting news.
Canadian man was sentenced for drunk driving after being pulled over in his mother's motorized wheelchair. 35-year-old man was fined and placed on probation.
And of course, music. No clouds in my stones. Entertainment, celebrities, you name it, we'll talk about it.
And of course, we love to hear from you. Send us your thoughts and comments. Our email address is upfront@voanews.com.
So don't forget to check us out every Wednesday at 1730 UTC on The Voice of America.